Hi folks, welcome to episode 19 of the Book Club of the Lotus Eaters, where Thomas and I will be discussing the Communist Manifesto. Dun dun dun. It's not nearly as dramatic as all that, to be honest, because once you understand it, you can see right through it, frankly. And so we thought it'd be interesting. We thought there'd be a lot in there that you guys would need to know. So a brief overview. It's essentially a political pamphlet published in 1848, about 60 years after the French Revolution, and definitely within that tradition of thought. They very much referenced that. It was translated into a series of major European languages, and it was very widely read and had a great deal of impact.
Yes.
And I think that one of the things I think is very interesting about it is the language used and the writing style used is very forceful, and it is very persuasive. And you do, after reading it, come away feeling like you could be on the cusp of a wave, an inevitable wave of history that is going to sweep across the world and conquer everything before it. And it's very, I mean, the confidence with which it's written is genuinely something else. And you can see why it was so seductive to so many millions of people.
And continues to be.
Well, and continues to be, exactly. I mean, I guess we'll begin at the beginning with A Spectre Haunting Europe.
A Spectre Haunting Europe. The inevitability that the proletariat will nonetheless arrive at exactly the same conclusion and choose the exact alliance that's being presented by Marx and Engels in this pamphlet. This is my interpretation, is an attempt to say this is the true socialism. This is the inevitable movement that needs to culminate.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, like, inevitability is packaged into the framework that they have here. But I love this opening line, yeah, a spectre is haunting Europe, the spectre of communism. That's not exactly an optimistic opening, is it? It sounds rather sinister.
It's a bit odd to describe it as a spectre. I mean, it would be more appropriate for them to say that that spectre is capitalism that haunts us, not the positive utopia that they're trying to sell.
Exactly, you know, like, they make the whole project sound rather sinister. And, you know, when they say, well, all of the great powers are in a holy alliance against it, it's like... Okay, so you're the unholy alliance?
Yeah, the language is probably designed to scare the capitalists, or at least to persuade onlookers. I imagine this bit was probably read out multiple times in conferences to say that, to almost make them seem kind of more powerful than they actually were.
Oh well, absolutely, and that when they say, you know, all of Europe is an alliance against it because it's all of the, you know, feudal orders. They say that, you know, this reveals communism to be a power in and of itself. And so they are playing some very interesting linguistic games in order to set themselves up as being a great power in their own right.
Yeah, and they're presenting them as a force, or at least planting the seeds for the idea that Europe knows them as this force, when I would argue actually it didn't. There were various, you could say, left-wing forms of socialism that were threatening the authorities across Europe, but they weren't as united as, well, Marx and Engels are claiming here. But they are nonetheless using this as a chance to sell that idea.
Yeah, and exactly. That's the point. Whether it was true or not, the point is they want the reader to believe that it's true, to buy into the ideology in order to make it true.
We're all part of this story.
Yes. Yeah. And it is a fantastic narrative, and it is a story. That's the thing. It's a story and a narrative that is very well written and internally consistent. You know, I can easily see how someone in the 19th century read this, coming away going, you know what, I think that's true. I think I'm a communist. You know, I can totally see how that was the case.
Yeah, even though it says very, very little about what a Marxist science actually looks like in this particular pamphlet.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's not the point, is it? It's a very convincing piece of propaganda.
It is, yes. You know? Yeah.
Right, so, I mean, where to begin? I suppose part one, bourgeois and proletarians.
Yes, bourgeois and proletarians.
So this, I think, is pretty good, because this gives us their theory of history. The communist theory of how history works.
Yes.
And again, they've got some very snappy, memorable lines. All of history hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. And then in a footnote, they say, well, all of written history anyway. And so, yeah, basically each class is considered to be eternally in conflict with one another. So no matter what period of history you're in, the various complicated arrangement of society, the various orders were always at war with one another. I don't agree that that's the way history worked, but
I don't. I literally believe the opposite. I'm a Hegelian. But he's basically saying that all of these classes emerge from impoverished social conditions, and ultimately the implied narrative is that the oppressed ultimately win eventually, and the last class ultimately to be toppled is the bourgeoisie.
Yes.
Yes. And of course, that utopia would be comprised of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which, yes. which wouldn't be a dictatorship because, well, this is the world of all resources for everyone.
Yeah, they frame it as if it would be the sort of like ultimate democracy. But I mean, you know, obviously that's not true. But I'm not worried about the truth of it. I just want to sort of like set the scene. So they present their theory of the origin of the bourgeoisie springing from the burghers of the cities of the Middle Ages, which is true. You know,
yeah, it is. I mean, the serfs kind of who basically tailed off from their lords were and moved to the towns because they just thought it was a better idea for them, which it probably was. The most successful of those comprised the affluent bourgeoisie that we know today. And they we'll of course go into this in more detail, but they genuinely kind of did a lot of good for society at that point.
Absolutely.
They were very, very innovative, but ultimately their time is now all coming to an end.
Yes. And from what's it called? The hangman of their own making or something like that, he frames it. But he puts it in the discovery of the Americas, the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope, opened up new markets, increased the volume and productivity of trade. The monopolies of the guilds of the Middle Ages gave way to the modern industrial system of production that monopolized production in the hands of the class of the bourgeoisie, the factory owners during the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, and this is all, I think, implicit in this is... whilst, of course, this came at the expense of a lot of communities, Marx is arguing here, was a necessary process of production becoming what it necessarily needs to become. Mm. This, after all, is the apparatus that the proletariat are going to inherit. As despotic as this is, it was needed to express itself in some form.
Yeah, and what they're saying is this is kind of like the inevitable conclusion of this sort of scientific revolution as well. Yeah. Industry is the product of science, and so once you universalize and make everything interchangeable, then you make, I mean, literally, you produce the mass production, and then in connection with the mass markets that they discover in the colonization of Americas and new trade routes to India and China, then the stage is set, and these things all come together. You know, they're not like one causes another. These are all like independently.
And what's important about this in Marx's case is that this is an expression of religious dogma, this idea of self-determination, free enterprise, free markets. This bourgeois freedom is
specifically bourgeois.
Bourgeois freedom, not freedom in and of itself, is an historical form of freedom that ultimately is meeting its end.
Mm. And so from this, they draw that the modern industry has established the world market. Mm-hmm. And I don't really agree that that's the case. I don't think industry established the world market. I think it was a concurrent development with it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, moving on, you know, they say that they conclude from this that the bourgeoisie is a product of a series of revolutions in modes of production and exchange.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
There is some historical weight to this, I suppose, given that production was ultimately at the center of everything that the bourgeoisie ultimately did. They were driven to become what they were because of the impoverishment of their own material conditions or dissatisfaction with what they were. Mm. Production is, of course, in industrial society what produces wealth. And they were ultimately, it's not so much the bourgeoisie kind of innovative agency that is the subject order of history here, it's production itself. Mm. Production, the bourgeoisie's actions are entirely governed by the fact that history necessitates it.
Mm.
So that's where what Marx is ultimately saying. This again is all dialectical materialism.
Yeah, absolutely. But as a literal statement, I don't know how much I really agree that it's purely about the modes of production and exchange. It seems to me that if you look at like the history of it, like even if industrial production wasn't created, it seems that there was a series of ideas that were leading to the end of feudalism.
Yeah,
you know. So even if industrial production hadn't become important, then that probably would have happened.
I fundamentally do agree with that, but it's not entirely wrong to say that there were, of course, I suppose, a small or at least very, very niche collection of bourgeois business people ultimately who saw things in strictly the politically economic sense. And Marx's flaw is not in pointing this out because it's true to a point.
Mm.
It's basically casting all of the bourgeoisie under this bus.
Yeah, I think the problem as well, it's a monomaniacal focus, isn't it?
Yes.
He's saying that it's merely the revolutions in the modes of production and exchange that has caused this. Like, no, but there are revolutions in all other aspects of life as well.
Mm.
You know, this, I mean, like the, and he's not wrong either, that the bourgeoisie is a revolutionary force in, say, in the time of the French Revolution. It was a bourgeois revolution, very much. And so he's not wrong, you know, and this is the consequence of that 60 years down the line. So, you know, basically true.
There's plausibility to the idea that the cold rationale that they end up developing does seem to be, have its roots in the in what Marx regards as religious dogma. But I also think that you could understand it, you know, I suppose this is more true of Protestantism as with anything else, that this is a natural development from a moral value system that they genuinely had. Like it isn't just an instrumental process beyond them.
I think
that's where he's a little bit egregious here.
When you read anything about the French Revolution, there's definitely a moral imperative that underlies it, as mixed and confused as it is. They definitely think they're being moral. But anyway, so alongside each advance in production came a corresponding increase in the power of the bourgeoisie, which I think is probably true, to be honest. And they, of course, the revolutionary part that he's referring to. And this is where I think it gets really interesting, because then we get to the hidden conservatism in communism. Wherever the bourgeoisie has conquered, it imposes a cruel materialist order, is what he's saying. I've got a couple of quotes. "The bourgeoisie, wherever it has got the upper hand, has put an end to all feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, than callous cash payment."
Does that or does that not sound like it could have been written by Burke?
Yes.
It does,
that's
doesn't it?
Exactly what
I mean, this could almost be interpreted, is this Marx lamenting feudalism, lamenting the loss of the patriarch, and lamenting the idyllic relations that have that are still inseparable from the moral universe that we inherit today?
Exactly. And it, like he's speaking very much to like the sort of the feeling and of the relationships between man and man, as in the feeling of security, of being in an embedded society where people have a proper place. Like, that's, I mean, this, the lament is the only word that comes to mind for that phrase, for that sentence. And that's very interesting to me.
It is. And he's basically renounced his materialism by page 5 as well.
Because
the value of these communities is inseparable from the institutions that's which makes them as such.
Yeah. I've got a couple more quotes. I'll go on. "It has drowned the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism in the icy water of egoistic calculation." It's not wrong.
No, it's not. I'm almost confused as to whether he's cherishing the bursting of religious fetters or he's again lamenting it.
Well, exactly. It sounds bad. Yeah. He sounds like a reactionary. He was like, "Well, we need to return to the feudal order, guys."
Yeah, he does. You
know, that's what that sounds like to me. He carries on. "It has resolved personal wealth into exchange value, worth into exchange value. And in the place of numberless, indefeasible chartered freedoms, it has set up that single, unconscionable freedom, free trade. In one word, for exploitation, veiled by religious and political illusions, it has substituted naked, shameless, direct, brutal exploitation. The bourgeoisie has stripped of its halo every occupation hitherto honoured and looked up to with reverent awe. It has converted the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the man of science into paid wage labourers. The bourgeoisie has torn away from the family its sentimental veil and reduced the family to a mere money relation." That's a deeply metaphysical statement.
It is, and it translates, or at least to me, as the bourgeoisie has basically declared war against society in the pursuit of self-interest. But again, I would say even for a conservative, that's extremely uncontroversial.
No, absolutely. It's again, as you said, it's deeply Burkean. And this is exactly what Burke is talking about. And it sounds, again, like a lament of materialism. So it's like, okay, well, why then pick up the materialist mantle and run with it?
Yeah.
You know, why do this? I mean, I suppose that he would argue something like, well, I think that it's now inevitable given the forces the bourgeoisie have unleashed.
Yes. Yeah, and that we've now got to run with this and at least make it work for the benefit of all.
Yeah.
But
there's a deeply conservative strain underpinning all of this, and I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
But I'll carry on, actually. "The bourgeoisie has disclosed how it came to pass in that brutal display of vigour in the Middle Ages, which reactionaries so much admire, and you, Carl, found its fitting complement in the most slothful indolence. It has been the first to show what man's activity can bring about. It has accomplished wonders far surpassing the Egyptian pyramids, Roman aqueducts, and Gothic cathedrals. It has conducted expeditions that put in the shade all former exoduses of nations and crusades." But it again, sounds like you're in admiration there for the previous, I guess we'll call it intuitive society, the relational society that's been destroyed.
I mean, no, I was going to say he's crediting it with, I suppose, bringing, you could say, primitive societies out of such states. And that this is all owed, well, he Marx would probably argue that he's not crediting the bourgeoisie. He's ultimately saying that they are a necessary agent in the productive process.
Sure, yeah. But what I mean is the pre-bourgeois regimes, the status. He's saying, well, they've surpassed all these things. But I mean, not in beauty, right? Like, he's not saying that what the bourgeoisie have done in his time are more beautiful than Gothic cathedrals or Egyptian pyramids or anything like that. And I just find that really interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, so another quote quickly. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epochs from earlier ones. All fixed, fast frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air, and all that is holy is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind.
I've got to say that this is probably one of my favourite quotes from this chapter.
It's excellent, isn't it?
It is fantastic. And what he's basically saying is that what makes the bourgeoisie unique as a class, and in order to sustain its position of power, it needs to constantly change the means of production. And it needs to do that because the proletariat knows how to run it and has a revolutionary incentive to make it work for itself if it does not do that.
And I like the framing as well, like the ancient and venerable prejudices, or the fast frozen relations, again, that he seems to be lamenting, all get washed away. So everything is just this constant roiling chaos. And that's implied to be a bad thing. And so that implies that Marx would be like, well, it would have been better if we just had feudal lords, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
No, he is explicitly always lamenting that, that it almost sounds like he's lamenting the loss of the division of labor. To a point.
Yeah, it does.
Because implicit in this quote is that there's almost something beautiful in the act of work.
Yeah.
And that something beautiful is kind of being taken away when these changes are necessarily brought about.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.